Anyway, welcome to CSIS for our afternoon session. We'll promise this to be a very stimulating discussion with a lot of energy over the next couple of hours. And I know of no one who follows the question of Europe's energy security more closely than our speaker today. In fact, he not only follows it closely, but is essential daily reading, unavoidable daily reading, I would say, on these intricate chess games between Russia and European Union, and sometimes between some of the European Union states. It actually looks more like a poker game at times. Vlad and I, by the way, go back almost a quarter of a century since we were extremely young analysts together at Radio Free Europe in Munich 25 years ago. And I'm convinced he's going to remain for the next quarter century one of the leading authorities, not only on oil and Russia's energy strategy, but also on European security. Before I turn to Vlad, who needs no real introduction, let me turn to Keith, say a few words, and then we'll get the ball rolling.
Well, it's really a pleasure to be here with Vlad. He's, you know, not only it's essential reading every day. I don't know how he turns out such high quality material on a wide range of issues, but mainly dealing with energy issues, but also the Bucharest summit and a lot of other issues. And I think that I don't want to go on because I've been writing myself about this subject, and I find that even one article for me is very painful. But he does one a day, which is an enormously impressive task, I must say, and very good quality. And I have to say, I always try to look for something that's wrong and haven't figured out yet what he's doing, because he must have the best fact checker in the world. Anyway, Vlad is over here. He's with the Jamestown Foundation, but is in Europe most of the time. And we just, in fact, were together in Tallinn, Estonia, just a couple of weeks ago, where he was also on the program. So I'm not going to say too much. You can read my stuff on the CSIS website. But Vlad, Georgetown Foundation, every day, they put out this report, and he's really doing an excellent job of kind of highlighting what I think is a very serious problem, which is underplayed by most of the European countries, which is the use of energy as a political and economic tool by the Kremlin. A subject which I think is needs to be paid more attention to, not only by Europeans, but also by Russians. If you follow the Financial Times in the last few days, you'll see that the oil production in Russia is declining, or will be declining very soon, because of a lack in investment in the industry. The gas industry is, in fact, flat, pretty much flat, because of the lack of investment. And all of this followed the great idea that was of Vladimir Putin to centralize the energy industry in the Kremlin and in the by a few people that were trusted by him and his associates. And unfortunately, the result of that is that the production in Russia is declining, or will be in decline, and they won't be able to meet their contracts to supply gas to Western Europe unless they are in firm control of the Central Asian production. So I think it's not only in the interest of Western Europe and the EU particularly, but in the interest of the average Russian that, in fact, Russia reverse course and go back to a system where there's more free enterprise and competition that operates, and transparency, because transparency, you find less and less transparency in the energy trade, which is having an effect on Europe itself, primarily on East Central Europe, but also on Europe as a whole. Less transparency, more corruption, and I think a weakening of sovereignty, particularly in the states surrounding Russia. Anyway, it's a real pleasure to have Vlad here and to be part of the program up here. Thanks, Vlad. And he's going to talk for a while, and then he's going to take a lot of questions.
Thank you, Keith and Janusz, for your generous introductions. I wonder if I can live up to such high expectations after these introductions. And it's the first time that I have the pleasure to share the panel with Keith and with Janusz in the United States, although we did previously share panels in Europe, including at the NATO summit just held in Bucharest. The NATO summit just held continued a discussion initiated a year and a half ago at NATO's Riga summit about Euro-Atlantic energy security. It is for the first time that this issue is making its way onto NATO's agenda. NATO properly regards energy security as a Euro-Atlantic concern for two reasons. The first is that European overdependence on Russian-delivered energy undermines the political cohesion of NATO and the overall cohesion of the transatlantic community. And second, because no single European consumer nation can achieve energy security on a national basis, but only on a European basis and on a Euro-Atlantic basis. Energy security must be regarded as a Euro-Atlantic concern because it is indivisible for the member countries of the Euro-Atlantic community. Failure to recognize this reality can jeopardize the very essence of NATO. Successive American administrations of both parties recognized this reality. Historically, American administrations A opposed American administrations opposed large-scale pipeline projects going from Russia, Soviet Union as it then was, and then Russia, to Western Europe, to European Union countries, and attempted to offer alternatives, pipelines that connect energy sources upstream to European consumer countries downstream, bypassing Russia. This has been historic U.S. policy. It has not yet become European Union policy, and it has not been the policy of the Bush administration during most of its time in office, until what looks like a semi-awakening that took place perhaps 1 year ago, belatedly. In my remarks, I will focus mainly, although not only, on gas, and then go on to make some remarks on oil. I will focus on gas because gas is the most dependency-inducing fuel for a number of reasons. First, because gas supplies are based on long-term contracts. Spot contracts, as they exist on the oil market, are not available for gas exported by pipeline. Second, because of the multiple uses of gas for electricity generation and for processing industries outside the hydrocarbon sector. Moreover, Russian gas deliveries have a tendency of spawning interest groups in recipient countries that have a vested stake in the long-term continuation of these arrangements with Russia in ways that privilege Russia over other consumers. These are some of the reasons why gas is the most dependency-inducing fuel. Indeed, Europe is falling into overdependency on Russian-delivered gas. I use the term Russian-delivered gas as distinct from Russian gas because a growing proportion of the Russian-delivered gas actually originates from Central Asia and is being sold or resold in Europe as Russian gas, an arrangement based on Russia's monopsony arrangement with Central Asian gas-producing countries, primarily Turkmenistan. Russian strategy calls for multiplying energy delivery corridors and pipeline systems reaching Europe. But Russia will have no possibility to fill these pipelines to capacity. There is a growing consensus among experts, which I think is conventional wisdom by now, that Russia will face a shortfall in terms of gas output and gas exports in the years after 2010, possibly beginning even in 2010. Shortfall, meaning the difference between actual output, including the intake of Central Asian gas, and supply commitments. Russia will have to supply four inherently competing sets of customers: European Union member countries, the growing Russian internal market in connection with the Russian gasification program of even remote regions of Russia, Russian industrial customers, many of whom depend on subsidized supplies of Russian gas to sustain a competitive posture on foreign markets, and the emerging Far Eastern customers. Four sets of customers, which, given the stagnant output of gas in Russia itself, will compete each other for limited quantities available, even if we take into account the Russian intake of Central Asian gas. Against this backdrop, Russia is building what looks like surplus transport capacity. At present, Russian gas reaches Europe and nearby countries through the Yamal 1 pipeline via Belarus and Poland, through the Beltrans-Haz transit pipeline of Belarus, therefore also via Belarus, through the Ukrainian transit system, which carries the lion's share of Russian gas deliveries to Europe, and through the Blue Stream 1 pipeline from the Russian shore to the Turkish shore of the Black Sea on the seabed. So there are basically two large corridors, Belarus-Poland and Ukraine, plus the smaller one, Blue Stream 1. In addition, as we all know, Russia is building the Nord Stream pipeline to connect the Russian end of the Baltic Sea with Germany on the Baltic Sea bed, and South Stream, the twin brother of Nord Stream, the South Stream on the seabed of the Black Sea, connecting Russia's coast with the coast of Bulgaria, to continue further to the southwest and to the northwest. So now you have four different corridors for the transport of Russian gas. There is no way in which Gazprom and Russia are going to be able to fill these pipelines to anything near capacity. We already have a foretaste of this situation with regard to the Blue Stream 1 pipeline, which was inaugurated in 2002 for a first stage capacity in place of 16 billion cubic meters per year, but is functioning at a quarter of that capacity, 4 BCM, almost certainly inflicting losses on Gazprom. Gazprom cannot recover its investment in that pipeline if the pipeline functions as it has since 2002, at one quarter of its design capacity. This shows that Gazprom and the Russian state are prepared to incur losses in the process of building surplus capacity. Why then the surplus capacity? A number of reasons. Surplus capacity and the existence of four, if Russian plans come to fruition, of four different transport corridors for gas will cause countries or groups of countries at the end of each pipeline to compete against each other for scarce supplies of Russian gas. Gazprom and the Kremlin behind it will be in a position of administering the delivery of an increasingly scarce commodity, causing countries in Europe to compete against each other for the privileged position of buying as much as possible of those quantities. Second, the building of surplus capacity has to be seen in conjunction with Gazprom's and President Putin's design to create a Russian-led cartel of gas exporting countries. This would-be cartel is known under the misnomer OPEC for gas. It is a misnomer because a cartel of gas exporters will not function in any way like a cartel for oil exporters. It will function in a completely different way, which I described elsewhere. It will be a cartel, not an OPEC, but a cartel. Gazprom evidently anticipates the era of gas output shortfalls. It apparently plans to retain dominance in European markets by channeling additional amounts of gas from member countries of the gas exporting cartel through Russian-controlled pipelines. This will enable Gazprom and the Russian state government to continue dominating European markets through transport rather than through quantitative deliveries. And it will form the spokes that come out of the hub that the cartel will form. You have to visualize this cartel as the hub of a wheel, with Russia at its center, dominating pricing discussions by virtue of Russia's superior volumes. And from this hub, various spokes are starting, are going out to reach the market. These would be Russian-controlled pipelines. Of these four corridors, the existing one, Belarus, Poland, and Ukraine, and the would-be ones, Nord Stream and South Stream, South Stream has a decisive strategic importance because what is crucial here is not only the actual pipeline, if and when built, but the route, the transit route. South Stream will control, if Russian plans come to fruition, South Stream will control the southern entry point into Europe for Middle Eastern and Caspian gas. If the South Stream pipeline is built at the projected capacity which will exceed Russia's delivery capacity, then the spare capacity would be available for Russian-delivered gas from the Caspian region or the Middle East. This is the great stake involved in whether or not South Stream will be built. While Nord Stream, harmful as it is to European energy security and onerous as it is to European consumers, Nord Stream would not have the additional role of foreclosing the route for alternative supplies from non-Russian sources. But South Stream, if built, would foreclose that route. It is therefore the more present danger. South Stream competes head-to-head with the Nabucco project of declared top priority of the European Union. Nabucco faces a number of hurdles that are most, for the most part, unnecessary, artificially created. And if recognized as such, they can be overcome. The first and foremost hurdle has to do with sourcing. Austria's OMV company planned or designed the Nabucco project in the mid-1990s in order to carry Iranian gas. The Iranian option became politically unpalatable after 9/11. Ever since that time, the Nabucco consortium is casting about sources of gas and not finding viable sources. Azerbaijan is correctly mentioned as the main source for the first phase of Nabucco. But there is no way in which Azerbaijan can supply, after the first phase of Nabucco, could supply the second phase of Nabucco, the Turkey-Greece-Italy interconnector, and the Baku-Tbilisi-Erzurum pipeline. Azerbaijan might be able to do that if it accepts a high rate of depletion of its gas reserves. Its gas reserves are huge. And Azerbaijan deserves praise and support for casting its lot as a nation, not only as an energy supplier, but as a national project, casting its lot with the West. But Azerbaijan's national choice must not be abused. Azerbaijan looks at the depletion rate of its oil reserves. Unless new reserves of oil are discovered in Azerbaijan, which remains a possibility, but it's highly uncertain. Barring that, Azerbaijan's oil reserves would run low or even run out by 2020. But the Azerbaijani leadership is already thinking about the nation's future and about the inheritance of new generations. Flush with income from oil that it can even hardly absorb at this time, it makes eminent sense for Azerbaijan as a nation to delay the full volume extraction of its gas reserves until after the oil reserves run low or out, that is, way up by 2020 at the earliest. Therefore, to ask Azerbaijan now to supply Nabucco 1, Nabucco 2, Turkey-Greece interconnector, Baku-Tbilisi, Erzurum at one and the same time is to place an undue strain on Azerbaijan. And it is also to present Azerbaijan with a possibly insoluble problem of absorbing oil revenues and gas revenues at the same time. Not a good idea. But investors will not be convinced about investing in Nabucco unless second phase reserves are already lined up, other than Azerbaijani ones. And of course, here Iran is inevitable. The notion that Nabucco can be supplied in a viable way from Iraq or from Egypt, these are just fanciful notions. And those who tell Nabucco and the European Union, potential investors, that Nabucco can thrive on Egyptian or Iraqi gas, those prescriptions are simply detracting from the credibility of the Nabucco project and are not taken seriously by European consumer countries or by potential investors. Iran needs to be brought in. We are in the presence of a classical situation of conflicting policies by the United States. Either using energy policy as a coercive tool on Iran in the context of Iran developing nuclear weapons, or alternatively, providing for Europe's energy supplies. These are two conflicting priorities, a classic case. It needs to be resolved in a credible way. More hurdles that Nabucco is facing. Coordination at the level of the European Union. Last fall, in October, I think, the European Union appointed an EU coordinator for Southern Corridor gas projects, focusing on Nabucco. The coordinator is the former Dutch foreign minister, Josias van Aartsen. 1 month ago, van Aartsen accepted appointment as mayor of The Hague. And the official word from him and from the European Union headquarters is that the job of Nabucco coordinator will be turned into a part-time job for van Aartsen, who purportedly would be able to serve as mayor of The Hague at the same time, and he will have sufficient spare time to take care of Nabucco. This is simply not serious. Not only does Nabucco need a full-time coordinator, given the extremely complex differences between the Nabucco consortium members, let alone the consortium and the potential suppliers. But this coordinator needs to have a competent staff, a competent full-time staff, because the intricacies of this project are multiple and complicated. In view of such problems for Nabucco, it is hardly surprising that we have seen recently a cascade of defections from the project. The socialist-led Hungarian government has dropped out of Nabucco and signed up on South Stream. It is important to make the following distinction, however. Hungary's privately owned energy company, MOL, is the Hungarian member of the Nabucco Consortium. The government is not a member. The private owned company, MOL, is the member. And MOL is thus far loyal to the Nabucco project, although it is tempted by Gazprom offers to build storage sites in Hungary. Those storage sites are a bait for MOL to defect from Nabucco. It has not happened, but it may happen if Nabucco does not persuade all concerned that it is a viable proposition. The Austrian government, which incidentally supports moves for an Austrian takeover of MOL, a takeover behind which Gazprom lurks, the Austrian government has turned over to Gazprom in joint ownership the designated terminal of the Nabucco pipeline, that is the Baumgarten terminal, which Gazprom promises to turn into Europe's third largest gas terminal, possibly even second largest of gas terminal in Europe, if Austria accepts South Stream gas in lieu of Nabucco gas. And Austria has signed up to this project. In other words, the Austrian terminal, which is the overall terminal for Nabucco, is now 50% Gazprom owned. Bulgaria has defected from Nabucco by signing up for South Stream. And Turkey is toying with, but seriously toying, with an alternative arrangement to Nabucco. That arrangement is known as the Blue Stream 2 project. I'll explain what this is. The pipeline on the Black Sea, on the seabed of the Black Sea, reaching Turkey from Russia, is Blue Stream 1. The original intent was to continue Blue Stream 1 in the form of Blue Stream 2 overland along the Anatolian landmass through the Balkans to Hungary and Austria, the same overland route as Nabucco. Russia gave up on the Blue Stream 2 intention in favor of South Stream, which bypasses Turkey. Turkey embarked on Nabucco as a result. But with Nabucco's real prospect dwindling, Turkey, like Austria, like the Hungarian government, and like Bulgaria, are losing confidence in Nabucco and are opting for the only alternative visible to them, which is South Stream. Romania alone is the good soldier in the Nabucco project. It has not defected and does not plan to defect. And this is because, in my view, of a correct analysis by the Romanian government of the drawbacks of South Stream, both in terms of cost of the gas that would be delivered through South Stream and in terms of the strategic consequences in terms of supply security. But unless Nabucco gets real in terms of upstream sourcing, then its members will defect one by one. The defections thus far are still reversible, but they will become irreversible in a short time from now. The solution, of course, apart from Iran, the solution is Central Asian gas, primarily Turkmenistan. And here we have a situation that is unique in the world of energy and geopolitics. Russia, number one worldwide for gas in terms of both output and exports, absorbs almost the entire output of Central Asian countries through monopsony arrangements, an arrangement unique in the whole world. Russia is combining Central Asian gas reserves with its own gas reserves in a single pool under Russian physical and commercial control to supply both Russia and Europe. The monopsony on Central Asian gas strengthens Gazprom's political and economic and political leverage on Europe. Turkmenistan's gas export potential is almost on the same magnitude as Gazprom's. The relevant comparison is not between output potential of Russia and Turkmenistan. The relevant comparison is between export potential. Turkmenistan's, with small additions from Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, has an export potential almost on the same order of magnitude as Gazprom. But neither the United States nor the European Union have made credible offers to Turkmenistan to compete with the Russian offers. 1 week ago, for the first time ever, a high-level delegation from the European Union, led by External Affairs Commissioner Benita Ferrero-Waldner, traveled to Ashgabat for a meeting with Central Asian ministers of foreign affairs to discuss precisely Central Asian gas supplies to Europe directly across the Caspian Sea. Following the meeting, the Kazakh foreign minister said in a chiding manner that we need from the European Union a project-based approach, a project-based approach. That means the EU needs to come up with supply contracts, with a consortium that would build a Trans-Caspian pipeline, and with the necessary investment funding lined up, which the European Union has yet to do after 7 wasted years. The policy of Turkmenistan is to sell its gas at the border. That's a declared policy of Turkmenistan. If the European Union and or the United States, or both in conjunction, and that would be the ideal approach, come up with the supply contract offers and pipeline offers along with investment offers, Turkmenistan might well buy into it. Of course, the first step is to have an audit, a credible audit, of Turkmenistan's overall deposits. This, too, has yet to be done. With regard to Nord Stream, actually, with regard to both South Stream and Nord Stream, we face a similar situation. Both projects, for the reasons I mentioned, are harmful to European energy security and burdensome to European consumers. They can be halted. I'm not saying they can be stopped. I'm using the word halted advisedly. Both projects would cross the exclusive economic zones of a number of countries, of 5 or 6 Baltic riparian countries in one case, and of Ukraine and Romania in the other case. Countries whose exclusive economic zones are being crossed by pipeline projects do not have, under international law, the right to veto those projects or to stop them, but they are entitled, under international law, to ask a great many questions about the environmental impact, about the impact on fisheries, about the consequences for navigational safety. These countries are entitled to demand changes in the proposed route. They also are entitled to oppose the construction of platforms on the high sea or of compressor stations on the high seas. This is the approach that Finland, Estonia, and Sweden are variously taking in relation to Nord Stream. Poland and Lithuania are preparing to take the same approach when asked, and they are about to be asked. Ukraine and Romania can take the same approach to South Stream. They could halt it in the Black Sea in the same way. Nord Stream has already been delayed by approximately 1 year for a number of reasons, including the questions asked thus far by Finland, Estonia, and Sweden. South Stream has an additional purpose. It is a bypass pipeline in a double sense, bypassing Ukraine and bypassing Turkey. Gazprom and Russia did not want to contend with Turkey as a transit country. That's why they propose a route through the Ukrainian and Romanian exclusive economic zone in the Black Sea. But South Stream is also intended to bypass Ukraine in order to reduce to the minimum possible the quantity of Russian gas carried through Ukrainian pipelines. Why? Not only because of concern over possible Ukrainian obstruction, that would be the Gazprom propaganda line. The real reason is to cut into Naftohaz Ukraine's transit revenue, force Naftohaz Ukraine deep into the red, and offers it cannot refuse for shared control over the pipeline system with Gazprom. Naftohaz Ukraine, deprived of revenue, is unable to invest into modernization and even repair. Gazprom could offer to do this in return for shared control in one form or another of the Ukrainian transit system. And that would be a major strategic blow to Europe as a whole and to Ukraine as a nation state. That's one of the rationales behind building South Stream to bypass Ukraine. Whether we want it or not, we come back to Iran and to the Russian project for a cartel of Russian gas exporters. Iran, of course, would be a key member of such a cartel. The policy of practically blocking or banning development of Iranian gas resources and even inhibiting development of oil resources in Iran is a U.S. policy that dates back to the mid-1990s, way before the nuclear issue arose. In the 1990s, we had all-time low prices on oil and gas. There was no question about the freedom of access to proven reserves of gas globally. And emerging economies had not yet emerged as competitors and claimants to global gas reserves. 12 years later, in 2008, the situation on the global and Eurasian markets has changed beyond recognition. What used to be all-time low prices have become all-time high prices for oil and gas. Physical access to reserves is increasingly under question. Remaining reserves are increasingly difficult to access geologically, not only politically. And Russia is emerging as a major threat to European energy security. The energy environment and the world of energy in 2008 is totally different from what it was in the mid-1990s when the policy toward Iran was put in place. Therefore, I would argue that the change in circumstances require a change of approach with respect to policy. Circumstances have outrun the policy by many years. If we want to prevent Moscow from creating a gas exporters cartel under its own control, we need to pry Iran out of that potential cartel. The cartel could hardly function without Iran. This is not to say, by any means, that we must put Central Asian gas on the back burner. Quite the contrary. The solution in the short term, to Europe's supply difficulties lies obviously on the eastern shore of the Caspian Sea, where again many years were wasted in terms of opening access to Central Asian gas. Let me now move to oil, and I'll be briefer on oil because, well, we may run out of time, but in any case, oil is a secondary concern compared to gas in terms of energy security for Europe. With regard to oil, again, we face a unique situation globally. Russia, number two worldwide as an oil producer and exporter, absorbs almost the entire oil export of Central Asian countries. And here, Kazakhstan, of course, is the main exporter. Kazakhstan plans to extract 130 million tons of oil by 2015, a huge amount. But it's going through Russian pipelines. Here we face, I think, at least two challenges. One, has to do with the direction of Kazakhstani oil exports. Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan, the oil pipeline that forms thus far the only Western success in the Caspian, the only major Western success in the Caspian Basin, depends for its medium and long-term viability and profitability on inputs of Kazakhstani oil in addition to the Azeri oil. That presupposes a westbound Trans-Caspian route for exports of Kazakhstani oil to feed into Baku-Ceyhan. That route is thus far being preempted by the Russian routes. A variety of pipelines, the largest capacity of which is that of the CPC, Caspian Pipeline Consortium Pipeline, CPC, is sucking Kazakhstan's available export availability. The pipeline goes overland from Kazakhstan onshore to Russian territory, terminates at the Russian Black Sea port of Novorossiysk, where it is picked up by ocean-going tankers. To prolong this route, Russian state oil companies are building the Burgas-Alexandropolis pipeline from the Bulgarian port of Burgas on the Black Sea to the Greek port of Alexandropolis on the Aegean Sea. This pipeline would be a prolongation of the CPC pipeline that runs from onshore Kazakhstan to Novorossiysk. It would form an enormous Russian-controlled export corridor from Central Asia to the Aegean Sea. This corridor would absorb, or is designed to, is intended to absorb, those Kazakh oil exports that would otherwise go westward across the Caspian Sea into Baku-Ceyhan. It is also designed to absorb the possible Kazakhstani oil exports that would go via Azerbaijan, therefore again westward across the Caspian Sea, via Azerbaijan to Georgian terminals on the Black Sea for further shipment by tanker to European Union countries via Ukraine and Romania. That is to say, via the Odessa-Brody pipeline, Odessa-Brody-Plotsk-Gdansk pipeline in the first place. So this Russian corridor that would be prolonged by the Burgas-Alexandropolis pipeline would in essence kill the Odessa-Brody-Plotsk-Gdansk project and other projects that would see Georgian terminals carrying oil to European Union countries across the Black Sea. Burgas-Alexandropolis, if built, and it's likely, it seems likely to be built, would become the first ever Russian state-controlled pipeline on European Union territory. This would not only kill the declared priorities of the European Union, such as Odessa-Brody, but it would also fly in the face of the European Union's own policy of demonopolization, diversification, and unbundling of the operations of integrated energy concerns. And this defiance of EU policy and of EU priorities would go on the territory of two European Union countries for the first time, Bulgaria and Greece. And this is as true as the fact that the South Stream pipeline would again be the first Russian state-controlled gas pipeline on the territory of European Union countries, in this case, Bulgaria, Hungary, Austria, and a spur through Greece as well, terminating in Italy, another European Union country. The European Union is not able thus far to deal with this challenge. The European Union is slowly developing, slowly and hesitatingly, a common energy policy in terms of an internally EU policy. But the European Union lacks entirely an external energy policy and an external energy security policy. The focus of such a policy could immediately become Central Asia, both in terms of oil and in terms of gas. And to conclude these remarks, what we see in Europe increasingly is the development of interest groups, political and economic, or rather economic and political, coalescing around Russian energy deliveries controlled by the Russian state. The volume, timing, schedules, directions, and in the case of gas, prices of these deliveries are increasingly controlled by the Russian state and by its chosen partners in selected European Union countries. So the risk to Euro-Atlantic energy security, the consideration with which I opened these remarks, is a mounting risk. This mounting risk requires a unified approach by Washington and Brussels. It does not seem likely that we can see initiatives in this regard in Washington before the change of administration. Once that happens, it is imperative to set up some kind of coordinating mechanism between Brussels and Washington to deal with this challenge. Thus far, the only transatlantic consultative and decision-making mechanism in existence is NATO. There is no other consultative and decision-making mechanism of the two sides of the Atlantic apart from NATO. That is why there is growing discussion about NATO assuming a role in terms of energy security. There is resistance from many West European countries against the idea of endowing NATO with such a role. To circumvent such resistance, it would be necessary to set up a specialized mechanism between Brussels and Washington, one that would deal with the common energy security, not as one aspect of a multifaceted and primarily security mission as NATO, but a mechanism dedicated to energy security policy. But I'm afraid we would have to wait for a new administration in Washington and for a new approach in Brussels to these issues. Thank you, and now I'll be happy, and I'm sure Keith and Janusz would be happy to take questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Vlad. We've wonderful to the force. We've left a lot of time actually for questions and comments and analysis. So please, anybody want to take the floor? Let me actually ask. Okay, Keith, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was gonna go back to your last remarks about U.S.-European cooperation. And obviously, you know, the pity is that Europe itself can't defend its own interests on its own, or won't defend its own interests. It can, but it won't. And the other day, I heard somebody express the idea that maybe the way to kind of push the European Union into some meaningful action is for NATO to take the initiative, a very strong push by the United States, by Britain, by a lot of the Central European countries, the Poles, the Romanians, and others, to push for a NATO, not only examination, but a NATO policy on energy independence. Not because they think that the Germans or the French or the Italians will in fact allow that to happen, but because by bringing this up and making a major push in NATO for this, it may embarrass the EU enough that it will finally do something meaningful.
Yeah, sure. I think that would be a great tactic.
Okay, anybody? Please, if you could introduce yourself.
Bob Nurek. Vlad, that was extremely interesting, as always. I have one... Two comments, I guess. One is a caution, and the second is following on Keith's. The caution is about the treatment of Iran. I mean, it's certainly true that Western and particularly U.S. policy, energy policy with respect to Iran, dates from the mid-90s, but it is not in the least bit sustained now by the same consideration. At the center of it now is the nuclear issue. The nuclear weapons issue. The current policies to try to cut off investment in the energy sector in Iran is part of the broader strategy to deal with the WMD issue. You're not going to change energy policy unless you address that issue. You're simply not going to get a hearing on Iran question unless you explain how you want to how you're going to deal with the nuclear weapons issue. I think there's an argument for it, but it's a very complicated one. So it's just a caution that I think you need to address that in your discussion of Iran of energy policy towards Iran. The second, just the point I thought I'd like to ask you about concerning EU policy. It seems to me there may be another, in addition to getting them excited by pressing the issue in NATO, another possibility had to do might be to take advantage of the current discussions about bringing the French back into the NATO military structure. Because, as I understand it, the condition. The key condition they're raising is British commitment, among others, to to re-energize the ESDP. And if we're going to have the EU do this, it seems to me this is a wonderful way to claim that the ESDP is now significant. So maybe, I guess the question is: A, do you think that this would be fruitful? B, what do you think? The British would have to play a key role here. Do you have a sense of what the British instincts on that question might be? Whether to give the EU through the ESDP a serious energy policy role?
Regarding Iran, I'm aware, Bob, of the considerations you mentioned. They are very serious and possibly even insuperable, at least in the short term. But my view on this is that the issue of gas development in the first place, but the overall issue of investment in Iranian oil and gas, needs to be made part of the discussion between the U.S. and Iran that a growing number of people are advocating in Washington. The first major proposal in this regard was the Council on Foreign Relations study in 2004, co-chaired by Zbigniew Brzezinski and Robert Gates, who was later to become Secretary of Defense, which advocated a comprehensive dialogue with Iran, encompassing the full spectrum of issues. Recommendations have since then multiplied in that regard. What strikes me is that of all issues that are being suggested as being put on the table as part of this comprehensive dialogue, which would definitely include the nuclear issue, absolutely, investment in oil and gas is seldom mentioned publicly in these proposals. There are proposals to open up this dialogue with Iran, as I said, on the full spectrum of issues, possibly with the nuclear issue at the center of discussions. But the oil and gas development needs to be obviously included in this discussion. The policy of keeping Iranian gas and even oil locked in the ground for a number of years ahead is an unsustainable policy. Along with dramatic underproduction in Iraq, so does dramatic underproduction of oil in Iran drive up the price of oil worldwide, also to American consumers, to European consumers, and drives up the price of gas, because gas prices are pegged to the basket of oil and other fuels, and other oil-based fuels. So as long as the discussion is continuing in Washington about a comprehensive dialogue with Iran, placing the nuclear issue at the center, it is necessary to include the oil and gas development issue in this dialogue. And I'm astonished that this is not being proposed. Regarding European policy, I'm not aware that it is proposed to integrate the European Security and Defense Policy, ESDP, with the external energy policy or with energy security policy. These are two separate tracks thus far. For a brief digression on the French return, on the proposed French return to NATO's integrated command, I don't expect this return to be unconditional. The reason why I don't expect this to be the case is that the same officials in the Quai d'Orsay are behind this proposal as were behind Jacques Chirac's proposal in 1997-1998 for a French return to the integrated NATO command. And at that time, that's the same set of officials who were then in mid-career and are now in late career, were posing conditions. One of the conditions, one of a set of conditions, being French command of the NATO integrated command in Naples, for example, where there is an American commander there. And other such, I would say, outlandish, really, outlandish conditions. And I fully expect some conditions when, if not the one regarding Naples command, then some other issue to be posed by the French. I also am afraid that the French consent with great fanfare to deploy 700 soldiers to Afghanistan, and by the way, not in the south but in the east, may also be a prelude to the French asking, posing conditions to the return in the integrated French command. And finally, last but not least, if the French do return, would they then claim a disproportionate role in planning NATO operations, as was the case when they were part of the integrated command? In fact, some people, including in the United States, regarded the French withdrawal from the integrated structure as a blessing in disguise. So there are a lot of unknowns regarding French policy. And I think that Sarkozy is rather unpredictable and perhaps overly spontaneous in some of his policy initiatives.
Bob wants to kind of come back a little bit.
Just very quickly to explain, first of all, I mean, as I've indicated before, I certainly agree that energy needs to be discussed with the Iranians, but you do need to make clear that this is, I mean, it seems to me that this would mark a serious change in current policy towards Iran in general, and in particular the Iran policy with respect to the nuclear issue. It is being discussed. I can tell you, in the non-proliferation and Middle East communities, it's enormously controversial. But the basic argument, I mean, it starts with saying that the current sanctions-based approach is not working. Not everybody is willing to either agree to that or agree to that now. But the argument basically says that we need a broader approach, of which energy would be part. But it is, it seems to me that's the way you need to cast the argument. On just very quickly on the French, I agree it's not going to be unconditional. I think the main and most difficult condition is going to be this link that they're drawing with re-energizing, reinvigorating the SDP. The command arrangements, Naples may be absurd, but I think if the broader political issues are settled, that they will find command arrangements for the French which will work. And I don't think it's just Sarkozy. It reflects, I mean, the White Paper Commission. There's a broader strategic review going on there, which I think is has given quite a bit of momentum to this idea, which is not to say that it's inevitable, I agree, but it seems to me there's an opportunity there. If there's going to be a deal anyway, which involves a commitment to reinvigorating and including U.S. support for a more important security role for the EU, it seems to me energy is, drawing that link together, it seems to me is a natural way to go.
I'm Leonard Oberlander. If you want to extrapolate from the current situation that you described, where Russia faces a gas shortfall in 2010 with regard to its current gas sources, including Central Asian gas, if you extrapolate by thinking of the source of the gas shifting from one place to another as a zero-sum game, a loss from one place can be replaced from another source, then if we add to the current sources Algeria and Libya, as well as gas from Iran, in a little futures projection, Algeria now provides the U.S. with 15% of its energy through liquid natural gas. If Gazprom would acquire the Algerian gas and control sales and transport, including to the U.S., this hypothetically could happen. And from what I had read, and I don't remember the source, Russia is building transport vessels now for large LNG transport. Also, there's a proposal for a Trans-Sahara pipeline to bring gas from Nigeria to Algeria. And who has the technology and the quality of specialty steel to build that kind of pipeline, as well as the contacts in the region and the influence of Iran, perhaps Gazprom? And then there's an unknown regarding what deals were made regarding contracts last week between President Putin and President Gaddafi, part of which was debt forgiveness and part of which was arms sales as part of the trade. And Iran will soon be becoming a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Will Algeria and Libya perhaps follow as regional expansion to that organization as NATO expanded to the east? What are your thoughts about this kind of a scenario? It's rather speculative, but how plausible is it?
Well, some of it is fairly plausible. It's not that speculative. This brings us to the issue of LNG. Only a short year or 2 years ago, LNG could be regarded, and was regarded by some, as the silver bullet against Gazprom's dominance of pipeline-delivered gas. Gazprom has taken counteraction on that front. Gazprom plans to acquire LNG technology, which it does not possess. Gazprom does not possess LNG technology. It plans to acquire it from several sources. It negotiates with a Canadian company and with Algeria's state company, Sonatrach, for building an LNG plant at the Russian end of the Baltic Sea, planning to export that gas in liquefied form on a fleet of tankers on the Baltic Sea. And this, of course, would compound the projected seabed pipeline, changing the Baltic Sea perhaps beyond recognition. So that's one front of LNG. The other one is in the Far East, where Gazprom last year forced out Shell, Mitsui, and Mitsubishi from their majority stake in Sakhalin 2. Now Sakhalin 2 is 50% Gazprom-owned, and part of the deal is for Shell to share its LNG technology with Gazprom for export to Far Eastern markets. By the way, Algeria, Sonatrach, has acquired LNG technology earlier from its joint venture with the Total company of France. Nowadays, Total is a partner, not a shareholder, but a partner, essentially a service provider, in the Shtokman gas field, offshore gas field project. And again, part of the price that Total is happy, by its own admission, happy to pay for access to Shtokman, is to turn over LNG technology to Gazprom. So Gazprom will be emerging soon as a major force in LNG in addition to pipeline-delivered gas. Gazprom's and President Putin's plans involving Algeria and Libya are two-dimensional. They involve in part LNG exports and in part pipeline delivered gas from Libya to Europe via Sicily and Italy. So this is emerging as a possible third front for Gazprom to enter the European heartland, in addition to the northern and southern corridors mentioned earlier. Northeastern and southeastern corridors mentioned earlier. Gazprom is now developing this southwestern corridor from North Africa to Europe. There are two keys to this. First, Gazprom joint extraction in Libyan and Algerian fields by Gazprom with the two national companies, joint extraction. And second, the second part of the deal is joint transport and marketing to Europe. And again, this would be an obvious case for a European Union common policy to function and to prevent Gazprom from raiding Europe's traditional supply bases. And yet, there seems to be no reaction to this. Thus far.
On top of that,
you could introduce yourself.
Yeah, Bernardo from the Embassy of Portugal. It was very interesting your exposition. But on top of that, Russia also has a price policy, and I would like you to speak a little bit about that. And also, my second question was: how do you evaluate the recent Bucharest NATO decision of not accepting Georgia and Ukraine,
yeah.
And also that, you know, because the European countries were the one who didn't accept that. So do you see that also as already an influence from all this energetic policy from Russia?
Yeah. Thank you especially for the second question, which is very interesting. But let me address the first question first about the pricing policy. Of course, Gazprom enjoys an advantage in setting prices because of the link of gas prices to the basket of oil-based fuels. And this, incidentally, was not a Gazprom idea initially. It was a German idea dating back to the 1970s, when the first large-scale Russian-German supply contract was negotiated. And at that time, it was Germany who proposed this linkage, which, at least in short term, seemed advantageous to Germany at that time. It no longer is. Questions of pricing are, of course, crucially important for private sector corporations, for their profitability, for the value of their shares. But it seems that we are slowly approaching a situation in which the key consideration may be physical access rather than competitive prices. We need to be aware of that. Because of scarcity, because of political control over reserves by unfriendly governments, governments unfriendly to the West, because of growing global competition, especially from emerging economies. Access, physical access, will soon be at a premium. I think that is a prospect that requires advanced planning, so that when this situation really materializes, we should not be caught unawares. Further on prices, the European Union until very recently, and of course the United States together with the European Union, until very recently, could use the pricing factor as an incentive for Central Asian countries to export their gas to Europe directly. Until March of this year, Russia was buying up Central Asian gas at very low prices, prices far below prices on international markets. And Russia was pocketing the huge price differential between the purchase price for Central Asian gas in that region and the sale price for Central Asian gas or Russian gas or Central Asian gas labeled as Russian gas in Europe. Russia was pocketing the differential. In March of this year, just 1 month ago, Gazprom offered a substantial price increase to the Central Asian countries. From now on, Russia, beginning in 2009, Russia will acquire Central Asian gas at prices approaching European levels, that is $350 per 1,000 cubic meters. This means that the European Union is losing the argument it had until recently that it can offer better prices than Russia to Central Asian gas. Russia's price offer is, of course, not an altruistic move. It reflects Russia's own expectation of a shortfall of gas output in Russia. That's why Russia is prepared to pay realistic prices to the Central Asian countries, starting in 2009, for their gas. And that means that we lose one important argument. Now about the possible correlation, that's a very interesting question. The possible correlation between dependency on Russian gas and political positions assumed by various European countries at the NATO summit, specifically with regard to the Georgian and Ukrainian membership action plans. Of course, there is in the long term a correlation between energy dependency and political positions on issues of interest to Russia. This correlation is undeniable, but we are not seeing it yet. And we did not see it at the Bucharest summit. What we saw at the Bucharest summit of NATO was still the prevalence of political and strategic considerations over gas dependency. This is comforting, but it's comforting only in the short term. Germany, heavily dependent on Russian gas, opposed the Ukrainian and Georgian membership action plans. But France, with one of the lowest dependencies on Russian energy and with the highest degree of reliance on nuclear energy, also opposed the Georgian and Ukrainian membership action plans. Not for reasons of energy dependence on Russia, but out of political and strategic considerations. By the same token, Central and East European countries, with their overwhelming dependence on Russian energy deliveries, joined forces in favor of the Ukrainian and Georgian membership action plans. This means that the correlation between energy dependence and political positions is not yet materializing. But I think we are only facing a short-term reprieve from the action of that correlation. It cannot be sustained for much longer.
I'm Joseph Gordon. You just mentioned nuclear. What are the prospects that nuclear power might be part of the equation as far as the security concerns, and that we follow, other countries follow the French model over time?
Yeah. I'm not an expert at all on nuclear energy. Joe Bader here might have a good answer to that. But living as I do in Germany, I can witness the effects of anti-nuclear ideology upon Germany's energy security posture. Due to ideological pressures from not only the Greens, who are out of government now, but are still substantially represented in parliament, and from most of the Social Democrat Party, nuclear energy is still regarded as highly undesirable. Germany has a political commitment to, as they say in the German language, to descend from nuclear energy. That's the term, to descend from, aussteigen, nuclear energy. As a result, as I mentioned, of ideological pressures from most of the Social Democrat Party and from the Green Party, and of course from the new party called the Left. And this has a direct impact on Germany's energy security policy, driving Germany even more into dependence on Russian gas.
Unless there's somebody else, let's see if there's somebody else that has a chance. We'll come back to you.
Thank you. My name is Hans Kordik. I'm from the Austrian Embassy. I enjoyed very much your presentation. Thank you very much for that. It's just, I don't directly have a question, just a point of clarification based on statements you made today, but also which you noted down in numerous articles in the Eurasia Daily Monitor concerning, you often speak about terms of certain economic ambitions between OMV and MOL of the Austrian government's ambitions. I need to point out that the OMV is privately owned mostly, just to 31.5%. It's state-owned. That's not enough to make decisions. In fact, the OMV makes its decisions autonomously. Thank you.
OMV is 31.5% owned by the Austrian government and 17% owned by the Abu Dhabi Investment Fund, which is also a governmental organization. In addition to the 31.5% stock officially owned by the Austrian government, there are small shareholders, very minor percentages, that are formally or informally controlled or influenced by the Austrian government. In addition to that, Austrian trade unions play an important role in Austrian politics and influence Austria's energy policy. Attempts to increase private control of OMV or to lay off the surplus labor force, which is characteristic of OMV, would run into resistance from labor unions who have a strong relationship with the Social Democrat Party leader in the government coalition. The Austrian government is strongly behind OMV's attempts to take over MOL, Hungary's MOL, in a hostile way. The Austrian government is actively lobbying in Brussels in favor of this takeover. Austrian government ministers have even publicly, on the record, proposed to the Hungarian government to take over a share of the 100% private MOL in order to facilitate a takeover or a merger between OMV and MOL. So OMV is very much a government-influenced entity. Again, thank you for a very interesting question. The argument of energy security certainly applies with regard to Georgia, because Georgia is the linchpin country on the designated transit routes for Caspian oil and gas to European consumer countries. And Georgia's destiny is inextricably linked to that of Azerbaijan. If one falls, the other falls. And success of the one spells success for the other. The odd aspect of the entire debate on membership action plans, the odd aspect, and it's a comment on the political culture of our time. NATO's debate as a military alliance about the desirability of opening its door to Georgia and Ukraine has not focused on strategic issues at all. It has focused on democracy issues, on economic issues, on issues of relations with Russia, by Ukraine and by Georgia. But oddly, for a military alliance, the strategic arguments, whether in terms of military security, military strategy, power projection, need to bring Georgia and Ukraine under NATO's Article 5 umbrella, all this has not figured in the debate. So when you have the West's military alliance stopping shy of invoking strategic considerations for the admission or non-admission of two key countries, then there is something wrong with our political culture. In terms of energy security, of course, Georgia needs to be brought in under NATO's umbrella, that's clear. But with regard to Ukraine, even if the energy security or energy transit argument is not as important as in the case of Georgia, then Professor Zbigniew Brzezinski's argument is, in my view, compelling. That a fully independent and viable Ukrainian state precludes the reemergence of a Russian empire in Europe. So that is reason alone for not only opening NATO's door to Ukraine, but coaching Ukraine to walk through that door.
Please. Brian Beery from Europolitics. You mentioned a third front. I'm wondering, is there a fourth front going to open up on the Arctic with the Russian oil and gas explorations there? How soon do you think it might realistically be a proposition to extract oil and gas from there, and how expensive would it be from your point?
I'm not aware of cost estimates regarding gas extracted from Stockman. Obviously, it would be enormously expensive. because of the conditions there. 500 kilometers offshore in the Barents Sea, most of the year, ice conditions most of the year, and so on. It would be enormously expensive. And gas from Stockman, if channeled through the Nord Stream pipeline, would increase the price, overall price levels in Europe by adding this high-priced gas. Thus far, it is not yet certain where the main supply source of the Nord Stream pipeline will be. Initially, the gas field in western Siberia, known as Yuzhno-Russkoye, was the designated source for Nord Stream. But volumes in Yuzhno-Russkoye are clearly not sufficient. Stockman is being touted as a source for Nord Stream. But the production from Stockman will have to be shared with the Russian internal consumers, both population and industry. So there will be a competition, again, an undeclared competition, between various sets of consumers of Russian gas once Stockman comes on stream, which is projected to happen by 2015. But before that happens, Russia will face this shortfall in terms of output because Gazprom is not investing enough, if at all, in new fields in Russia. Gazprom is investing in non-core assets. It's investing massively in non-core assets, in all kinds of projects totally unrelated to the gas industry, subsidizing the Olympic Games, building all kinds of things throughout Russia, and of course trying to buy expensive infrastructure and processing plants in Europe. So there is no answer to the question, what will happen to Russian gas supplies between 2010 and 2015? This period of supply shortfall in Russia is the last window of opportunity for the European Union and the United States to get their act together in terms of Central Asian gas, first of all, and then Iranian gas.
Bill Sifkin, CSIS. What about China, which has a player in all of this now, since there is a big Chinese push to access, particularly the gas resources out of Central Asia?
China is one of the claimants for Central Asian gas reserves. Personally, I don't take the Turkmenistan-China pipeline project that seriously. The resource base of the project to the east of the Amu Darya River in Uzbekistan is by no means certain. In fact, it seems that the Chinese are becoming involved in building this pipeline before estimating in any reliable way the resource base on the eastern shore of the Amu Darya River. Turkmenistan's latest gas discoveries are the fields fairly close to each other, South Yolotan and Osman. The output from these fields has not been preempted by Russia through supply contracts. Those supply contracts, which run out in 2009, concerns fields already in operation in Turkmenistan. But the newly discovered fields, South Yolotan and Osman, are not yet covered by any supply agreements. Those two onshore fields, in addition to the unprospected offshore platform of Turkmenistan, are the places where Europe can make immediate offers for future supplies.
Let me ask you a question, Vlad. Could you tell us a little bit, give us a sort of brief overview of, we mentioned OMV, but how German, French, Austrian, Italian, other majors are sort of drawn into reinforcing Russia's energy policy and precluding a sort of common European approach. If you could sort of spell out a little bit more on how this happens.
I'll try first with respect to Germany, because Germany is by far the most important factor in this equation. Germany has this long-term supply contract with Gazprom since the 1970s. And the history of this agreement is very relevant. Initially, this was supposed to be a contract for Iranian gas delivered through Russia. In the 1970s, there was a three-way negotiation between E.ON Ruhrgas, Germany's number one gas trading company, Iran, in the times of the Shah still, and Gazprom. The idea was a swap deal. Iran would deliver a designated amount of gas to Russia for consumption in Russia, and Russia would then deliver gas of the same value at the western border for German consumption. The Islamic Revolution and the arrival of Khomeini in 1979 put an end to this project. Khomeini decided that Iran should not supply Western Europe with gas, either directly or indirectly via Russia. And so the three-way deal based on that swap became a bilateral Russian-German deal. Germany is very happy with what it regards as Russia's reliability as a supplier. The same is true of Austria. Austria had its agreement even before Germany in the late 1960s. And Austria is also very happy with that. Russia's reliability came under serious question marks in 2006-2007. In 2006, as we all know, Russia's three-day interruption of gas supplies to Ukraine had repercussions downstream, farther out downstream, in European Union member countries, consumers of Russian gas. Hungary and Italy were among the European Union member countries directly affected by the supply shortfall caused by Russia when it turned off the gas to Ukraine, January 2006 and February. In January 2007, Russia had a dispute with Belarus over oil transit through the Druzhba pipeline. Belarus attempted to introduce a transit fee for Belarus servicing Russian oil transit through the Belarus section of the Druzhba pipeline. There was no transit fee. Belarus was providing the service gratis. In retaliation, Transneft cut off entirely the supply of oil to Belarus, resulting in supply shortfalls for a few days to half a dozen European Union member countries, including new member countries, Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, and old member country, Germany. Chancellor Angela Merkel said, January 2007, that Russia's move, quote, destroyed confidence, unquote, in Russia's reliability, destroyed confidence. This was soon forgotten. In the summer of 2007, the Lukoil company cut off its supplies to two of Germany's largest refineries, both situated in former GDR territory, Schwedt and Leuna, causing the two refineries to incur serious losses. Lukoil made that move because of an attempt to cut out an intermediary company that is handling Russian oil supplies to Germany. Incidentally, a Russian company headed by a Russian citizen. In a dispute, Lukoil tried to cut out this intermediary. And again, the casualty of a dispute involving Russia and a third party was a European Union consumer country. This time, the German government kept mum. No one said that this was a confidence-destroying move. The German government kept it under wraps and preferred to handle it untransparently. I don't know how this was resolved, because it remains untransparent. About gas. E.ON Ruhrgas, as mentioned a moment ago, is the main Gazprom customer for the consumer market, for the residential consumer market and municipalities. But the main industrial consumer is the chemical company BASF, the largest chemical concern worldwide. BASF's competitive posture globally depends, or it feels that its posture depends on guaranteed and sure access to Russian gas for BASF's own chemical production. It is BASF through its gas subsidiary Wintershall who is at the cutting edge of the strategy of sharing supply infrastructure in Germany with Gazprom. It was Wintershall who pioneered this method of obtaining access for long-term access to Russian gas supplies in return for giving Gazprom a share of up to 50% in German gas distribution systems downstream. And not only in Germany, but also in some nearby countries owned by Wintershall. The looming shortfall in Russian gas output and supplies has led to two different types of reaction. One reaction is opportunistic. Companies like BASF are rushing to obtain long-term access to dwindling supply or to stagnant supplies, edging out other European potential customers. I call this the opportunistic reaction. Others are trying the strategic response. The strategic response being to open access to non-Russian gas supplies or through routes that bypass Russia. So you have these two different responses to the looming Russian shortfall, the opportunistic response and the strategic response. In Germany, there has grown a powerful community of vested interests around Russian energy deliveries, and it directly impinges on the policy of the government. This situation is in large measure a legacy of the Schröder government. As you know, Chancellor Schröder is the chairman of the board of the Nord Stream Consortium and is a Gazprom employee. The general manager of the Nord Stream Consortium, named Matthias Warnig, is a former Stasi, German East GDR secret police officer, who was Putin's contact during Putin's days in Dresden. This information is all over the German press, has been for years, all over the German press, but it has no political effect. Chancellor Merkel does not represent the Schröder legacy. However, in the controversy surrounding the Georgian and Ukrainian membership action plans for NATO, I use the expression that Chancellor Merkel has out-Steinmeiered Steinmeier. Steinmeier is, of course, a career-long close associate of Gerhard Schröder, now the head of the Social Democratic Party, vice chancellor and minister of foreign affairs, and the legatee of the Schröder line in foreign policy. But with regard to the Georgian maps, it was the chancellor personally, and her chief political advisor, Christoph Heusgen, who took the lead in opposing the Georgian and Ukrainian membership action plans more zealously and more creatively than Steinmeier ever did. Steinmeier did it professionally, diplomatically, in a conventional way. Chancellor Merkel went out of her way to supply long lists of reasons, spurious reasons, why Georgia and Ukraine should not be admitted to membership action plans. Now, with regard to Italy, Italy's Eni is a close ally of Gazprom ever since Soviet days. Eni's weakness was never having a resource base of its own. Except in recent years, it has developed something of a resource base in North Africa, but it's still small and it's sharing it with Gazprom at this time. But historically, Eni had no resource base of its own. It made a close alliance with Gazprom to share segments of the Italian market with Gazprom. The Italian gas market is second largest in Europe after the German market. This enables Eni to sustain its competitive position as a major European gas trading and, to a far lesser extent, gas producing country. With regard to Austria, Austria is really being subjected to temptations that are hard to refuse. Austria is something of a hub for Gazprom's deliveries to Europe. Austria, by virtue of its location, has the potential of becoming the place where various pipelines can fan out the trunk pipeline would terminate via Slovakia into Austria, and from there it can fan out into various directions in Europe. And Gazprom is tempting Austria with the prospect of becoming Gazprom's Central European hub. Now, this prospect of becoming a hub is a ploy that Gazprom is using in relation with about 7 or 8 European countries at one and the same time. Gazprom has offered a hub position to Austria, to Hungary, to Bulgaria, to the Netherlands, and to Belgium at one and the same time. Again, there is no way Gazprom can sustain a hub position for all these countries or for a few of them at one and the same time from Gazprom's own deliveries, including Central Asian gas deliveries. But the result is that these countries are competing against each other for the grace of Gazprom to make them into a hub. And Austria seems to be the front runner in this regard. As I mentioned earlier, the Baumgartner terminal near Vienna, which is a designated terminal of the Nabucco pipeline, is now a 50% ÖMV Gazprom venture. And moreover, Baumgartner stands to become the terminal of Gazprom deliveries to Central Europe coming via Slovakia. And Austria is also expecting the South Stream pipeline, if built, to terminate at Baumgartner. Thus, Austria becomes a key hub for all of Europe. Austria wants to turn Baumgarten also into a major trading center and commodity exchange for Russian hydrocarbons reaching Europe. And the government really believes that it has that chance in close cooperation with Gazprom. In fairness to Austria and in fairness to Hungary and even Bulgaria, they don't have credible alternative offers. Had Nabucco been able to draw on Central Asian gas via a Trans-Caspian pipeline that would then connect via Azerbaijan with Nabucco in eastern Turkey, then all these countries would have had a credible alternative. But the alibi or the excuse of these governments is we don't have alternative offers. And up to a point, this is true. That's why it would be important to halt South Stream in the Black Sea in order to allow time for the Nabucco project to become regenerated.
Now it's your turn. Sorry, then I'll
go. Picking up on the last couple of questions with regard to European energy security, the strategic sector in Russia is vertically integrated and centrally managed with the same government officials, the same people serving on the boards of the large corporations in the strategic sectors, while in Europe, the energy-related corporations are separate from the government and not government and don't have uniform policy and actions coordinated by the government, with some exceptions, but for the most part. And two examples would be RV in Germany and MOL Hungary, which resisted takeovers. And RV fought off a takeover bid by Gazprom last year, which would have put into the hands of Gazprom pipelines in the Czech Republic, as well as water pipelines in southwest U.S. owned by American Water Works, which RV acquired several years ago. It seems that MOL and RV and their resistance has been very effective, but the corporations like that are few and far between in their resistance to a uniform kind of policy that is perceived as a threat to European energy security. How do you think of the advantage of a uniform government corporate structure over policy and management versus the independence of corporate policies in Europe with regard to government, where they're sometimes in opposition, where the bottom line is profit for the corporation and not national not European security.
I mentioned a moment ago the issue of political cultures in connection with the debates in NATO. And you are now putting your finger on an issue of economic culture. The fundamental question is whether the economic system in the West as presently constituted, whether it is able to resist piecemeal takeovers by non-market actors, such as Russia, and whether it is able to provide for energy security when facing the non-market or indeed anti-market policy of Russia and its state-controlled companies. The idea of mutual dependence or reciprocal access between Russian state companies on the one hand, or Russia as a state on the one hand, and West European consumer entities, countries, governments, companies, on the other hand, is a misconception. Russian state companies, such as Gazprom, face a multiplicity of Western buyers, uncoordinated with each other, indeed sometimes competing against each other, giving Gazprom and other Russian state companies an inherent advantage. So that's one consideration. The second consideration is that Russian state companies such as Gazprom and Rosneft have been very successful in raising funds on Western capital markets, for example, through IPOs in London. Again, non-market actors taking advantage of the openness of Western markets to the detriment of Western consumers and to the detriment of Western companies trying to compete. Thirdly, because of the increasingly acute question regarding physical access to reserves, including access in Russia, private corporations are competing against each other for contractual access to Russian reserves. In many ways, the valuation of shares of these private corporations depend on the value of their booked reserves in Russia. The more a private company is able to demonstrate that it has booked reserves in Russia or has contractual access to Russian reserves, the more the value of its shares rises, and vice versa. And this threatens to create a perverse situation in which Russian state policy can act as an arbiter in the competition among Western companies on the stock exchange in terms of share valuation and in terms of book values of proven reserves. I don't think that the European Union or the United States, for that matter, has found an antidote to this. Mm-hmm. How do we reconcile our free market economy with a coordinated, possibly even government-coordinated, approach to contain Russian energy expansion through the instruments just mentioned? It is an unanswered question.
I have Rita was first, didn't they? Could you switch your microphone?
Margarita Sandwich, Institute for New Democracies. I have a question that's related to the demands of the West to the countries in Central Asia to democratize, protect human rights, and how these demands are affecting our dealings with Central Asian countries. Does it prevent the project approach to take place sooner rather than later?
It's a very appropriate question because the attempted linkage of the democracy agenda with the energy security agenda has tended to hamper either of them. Fortunately, the era of color revolutions is behind us. until now, a European Union, to the extent to which the European Union approached Central Asian countries for energy supplies, to that extent, European interlocutors tended to merge the two agendas. Far be it from me to say that the democracy or human rights agenda is not legitimate or not important. But my recommendation would be to pursue the two agendas on a parallel tracks through the specialized appropriate institutions of government and not to mix the two when European Union authorities approach the Central Asian countries. There are institutions mandated to deal with human rights and democracy, both governmental and non-governmental organizations. And then there are institutions mandated to deal with energy security. And I think that the two should be kept on separate parallel tracks without in any way diminishing the importance of the democracy agenda. Secondly, when it comes to the democracy agenda, the appropriate focus should be on institution building and on enhancing the viability of governments in energy supplying countries. One case in point is Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan does not have a democratic political system. Neither does it have a dictatorship by any means. If anything, a French historian referring to another country spoke of the concept of dictatorship of respect. That country happened to be the interwar Czech Republic, and the dictator of respect happened to be Tomas Masaryk. But without comparing Ilham Aliyev or Haidar Aliyev in any way with Tomas Masaryk, Azerbaijan is a sort of dictatorship of respect. And Azerbaijan is on the verge of major success as a modernizing Muslim Shia majority nation. Really an example to hold up because of its successful modernization and because of its strategic choice of integration with the West politically and economically. And so Azerbaijan is a success. And I believe just as Kemalist Turkey initially served as Azerbaijan's model, in the same way, I think Azerbaijan can serve as an example for East Caspian countries. And Kazakhstan is, in an economic respect, a roaring success. Kazakhstan is successfully modernizing at breakneck pace and is successfully managing those challenges. So yes, democracy agenda parallel with an institution, especially institution building agenda, in parallel with the energy security agenda.
Keith? And just one observation and then a kind of a question. One of the things that my trips to Brussels and other European capitals brings out is there really is an indifference, and I would say a very strong indifference in let's say the more institutional countries of the European Union about the new ones. They just don't give a damn, quite frankly, about the security of these countries. This is not an issue in Western Europe. And if you read, there's a new book out, A Post-War, a very good history of post-war Europe by Tony Jude, you can see that even after World War II, the countries of Western Europe really were not concerned about the security of the countries to the east. And you see it today. As I travel around, I keep hearing from West Europeans, well, Russia has always been a consistently reliable supplier of energy. But if you live east of the German-Polish border, you know that's not true. Or at least it isn't true for them, but it may be true pretty much for Western Europe. But these are countries now in the European Union. And tell that to a Lithuanian, a Latvian, Estonian, a Pole, Ukrainian or something. Anyway, that's just the observation. The question really gets down to more of the issue of why does the European Union has some tools. Article 82 of the EC Treaty, which prohibits antitrust, anti-monopoly activity by foreign companies. the article, well, there's other articles, 45 of the Energy Charter, but why do they not enforce the anti-monopoly, antitrust articles with Gazprom and Transneft? That would be, that would require them to open up, and it would, to some extent, solve the issue.
Keith, you once listed the cases of Russian supply interruptions to the Baltic states, even after the Baltic states became members of the European Union. Would you like to tell the audience about this?
I first visited the Baltic states in 1992, and in the midst of an interruption. So that kind of honed the mind. But even after they became members, you have you've had a cutoff to which continued to Latvia on the part of the Druzhba pipeline, and Lithuania, which has been cut off permanently, pretty much, it looks like, from Russian energy sources. So I think this, and this is a long pattern which goes back, and Robert Larson, our colleague, has listed 40 interruptions or threatened interruptions of energy on the part of Russia. But these are things that, I mean, the European Union kind of turns its back on. You see very little reaction in Brussels. A very weak Director General for Energy, a very weak Director General for Energy and Transportation. But the question is, why does the European Union not enforce its own antitrust laws? Mrs. Kroes is a tough woman, and she's very hard against Microsoft. Why not using the same thing on Transneft and Gazprom, which is much more damaging to the consumer in Europe?
Why Microsoft? Why not Transneft? Why not Gazprom?
Yeah. Well, Keith and I were talking about this before the start of this panel. And we were thinking about how many European Union member countries could join forces to bring a legal challenge in competition terms to Gazprom. I think we counted about maybe five or six European Union member countries, mainly from among the new member countries, but possibly from among old member countries in the Nordic region.
And Britain, indeed,
who might join forces to bring such a challenge, which is obviously overdue. And if it's brought up by a group of countries acting on their own accord, they would not be subject to a German or some other veto inside the European Union.
Okay, I think because we've only got a few minutes, I will ask him one more question, actually. This is concerning really the U.S. response. If you had, let's say, 5 minutes or maybe less with the new U.S. president, whoever he may be, well, we know who she would be, but if you had, let's say, 5 minutes with the new U.S. president, how would you concisely summarize what is the Russian energy policy threat to U.S. national security interests? You know, what points would you make? One, two, three.
I would first cite or invoke the historic concerns evidenced by previous American administrations about European overdependency eroding the political cohesion of the Euro-Atlantic community and jeopardizing NATO's ability to develop common policies regarding common challenges on fronts other than energy. Second, I would argue in favor of proposing to the European Union a joint consultative mechanism, consultative in the first stage, to evolve into a decision-making mechanism in the follow-up stage to safeguard the common energy security. I would underscore that energy security on both sides of the Atlantic is indivisible. Otherwise, we put NATO at risk politically. I would then argue that it is necessary for the free market-devoted United States to develop an effective governmental mechanism for promoting U.S. and Euro-Atlantic energy security. Following and carrying forward the model that was incipiently developed by the Clinton administration, which had a machinery within the U.S. government to coordinate energy policy and even, to some extent, to arm twist energy companies and to lobby financial institutions for underwriting Caspian energy projects. The Bush administration dismantled that mechanism. It was an incipient mechanism, but it needs to be developed further to a higher degree than was the case during the Clinton administration in those halcyon days or happy days of low energy prices and unquestioned physical access. Then I would propose to this incoming American president to travel personally to Brussels. First, to organize a high-level, a top-level meeting of European leaders with the U.S. presidency, travel to Brussels, hold this meeting in Brussels, because Europe is the primary consumer for Central Asian and Caspian oil and gas, and launch this common initiative, the consultative mechanism potentially to develop into a joint decision-making mechanism. And then I would use the bilateral relations between the United States and the new member countries of the European Union in order to develop within the European Union a critical mass of countries that would change beyond recognition the European Union's energy policy in the external dimension, and that would lobby in Brussels and turn around policy in Brussels, focusing on Central Asian and Iranian oil and gas. These would be my spur-of-the-moment recommendations if, by some unexpected development, I would find myself face-to-face with the president-elect.
You did it within 5 minutes, which is excellent. Actually, Vlad told me before that some people refuse to believe that he can possibly write so much, and they think that Vlad Sokol is actually a group of writers who take turns each day to write something. So we'll have one of the Vlad Sokols back very soon. Thank you very much, Vlad. Great job.